Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 51. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we've got a couple of English horror films. One better than the other, but both very interesting. First off, we have the 1988 silliness of Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm, starring Peter Capaldi and Hugh Grant. And then we go a little bit further back to 1973 for a little interesting horror film called Deathline, also known as Raw Meat, starring Donald Pleasance. And so I'll get the credits out of the way and we'll get started with the silly wonderfulness of these horror films. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey people, it's 2015, which is very futuristic and groovy if you are as old as I am in particular, but I'm not going to talk about Back to the Future 2 or any crap like that, because to be honest with you, I didn't like the Back to the Future movies. I thought they were a bit middle of the road and white bread, and I'd read all of the kind of time travel tropes that were in them in much better works, and I was never that keen on Michael J. Fox to start off with. So I'm not going to touch that one. But, yeah, we survived the holiday season. Sal and I got through it. New Year's Eve was very quiet. We just kind of stayed at home and had some lovely seafood together and watched a couple of movies and just kind of celebrated it like that. Last year for us, as well as a lot of other people apparently, wasn't the best year in the universe, but we always have hope for the new one, and hopefully a few hassles that we have will get resolved. And I hope if you have any hassles that they do as well. So this time around we're looking at English horror films. We're looking at Lair of the White Worm, Ken Russell's silly movie from 1988 starring some silly people, and Deathline, really interesting little horror film which I first saw in the cinemas when it first came out, which is, I kind of have an odd fondness for movies that I first saw in cinemas back in the day, because for me cinemas at that stage were a sanctuary. They were an escape from some pretty rotten situations in my early life, and I went to see an eclectic bunch of films including Deathline. I'm kind of trying to remember which cinema I saw it in, but I can't. It may have been the State Theatre in Sydney, which was then showing horror films and other schlocky pieces of trash entertainment. But one way or the other, I liked the film, and revisiting it now, I found some more interesting things about it that I wasn't quite tuned into at the time I first saw the film. So what have I been watching? I've actually hit 2015 quite hard as far as watching movies are concerned. For no good reason, I rewatched the Blade trilogy starring Wesley Snipes, and Wesley Snipes has the charisma of a brick. That's what I've decided about them. Yes, they're good horror movies, and I've just got to let a cat in. I'm going to continue talking about Blade in just a moment when I let the cat in. And I'm back. Yeah, Blade, no subtlety at all. Yeah, hyperkinetic action film trilogy. Third one apparently had a lot of trouble with production, particularly with Wesley Snipes. Patton Oswalt is in it, and he has mentioned the problems that occurred during the making of Blade Trinity. But I just kind of wanted popcorn movies. I just wanted to shove them down my eyeballs. And I did that with those ones. Let's see what else I have watched, he said, taking a look at the screen again. Been watching the Carry On movies, those silly British comedies from the 1950s to the 1970s. We dragged out the box sets we've got of those, and kind of I started mainlining them from the first one onwards. And yes, they're silly, and with a lot of
kind of music hall sexual innuendo in them, but you get some interesting character actors showing up now and then. So I've kind of enjoyed that. And then I went back to, again, action films, some very, very silly, very hyperkinetic action films. I watched Crank and Crank High Voltage, starring Jason Statham, written and directed by Neville Dean Taylor. And, yeah, I do like the fact that visually they're exciting and stylish, and Chev Chelios, the character that Jason Statham plays, is basically insane. I've got a great fondness for those for that reason. It's just kind of silly, over-the-top, low-rent filmmaking, which just happens to be a hell of a lot of fun. And I kind of enjoyed revisiting that. It was the new year. The weather was starting to get oppressively hot. Yesterday here it was 105 degrees Fahrenheit, about 41, 42 degrees centigrade. And then the weather broke and we got lots of rain and stuff like that. But it was a time when it wasn't good to go out doing stuff. And so just kind of mainlining a whole bunch of movies seemed to be called for that reason. Stay in the air conditioning, stay in the shade, and just drink lots of fruit smoothies, which is pretty much what I did. And coffee, of course. Coffee is always there. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to start talking about the first of the two movies. I'll go in reverse chronological order for this because I want to. And the first film I'm going to talk about is The Lair of the White Worm, directed by Ken Russell and starring Hugh Grant, Peter Capaldi, whatever happened to him, Sammy Davis, Amanda Donahoe, and Catherine Oxenbould.
Thomas De Quincey's classic, Confessions of an Opium Eater. The motion picture screen's nightmare zone of terror and suspense. Confessions of an Opium Eater dares you to step beyond the threshold of your own imagination into a world of grotesque phantoms, bare-fanged beasts, and sensuous creatures of tormenting beauty. See Vincent Price in Confessions of an Opium Eater.
Your time has come, Eve. Come here. You will have the honor of being sacrificed to Diomin alive.
There is a legend of an ancient evil.
Something's been found in Stone Rig Cavern.
A legend that no one would ever believe.
Legend has it that Stone Rig Cavern was the lair of the Dampton Worm.
Unless, of course, it came right up and bit him.
I hear you're having trouble with a snake.
Dionon was a pagan snake god.
I'm snake watching.
It's as if they were just swallowed up.
John Dampson went a-fishing once, a-fishing in the weir. He caught a fish up on his hook. He thought, look mighty queer. Now what the kind of fish it was, John Dampton couldn't tell. But he didn't like the look of it, so he threw it down a well.
Ha! Well, you mustn't take the word worm too literally. It's an adaptation of the Anglo-Saxon virum, meaning dragon or snake.
The experience of a lifetime.
Now the worm got fat and growed an awful size, with great big teeth and a great big mouth and great big goggle eyes. So John set out and caught the beast and cut it into halves. And that soon stopped it, eating babes and sheep and lambs and cats. Yeah!
From the director of Altered States and the creator of Dracula, a new movie of venom and vengeance, Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm.
I'm famished. We stop on the way for a bite.
Watch out for your ass.
That, of course, is the trailer to Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm, based on Bram Stoker's The Lair of the White Worm, one of his least regarded novels. There was a 1925 abridgment of the Bram Stoker novel, which is the version of it that we have available to us at the moment, and it's a dog's breakfast. It really is bad. It was originally published in 1911, the year before Stoker died, and had colour illustrations in it as well, which would have made it more interesting. But the 1925 edition cut it way down and really cut the guts out of the novel, even though it isn't very well written. You can get it on Gutenberg.org, and I've gone through about the first chapter of it, and yeah, it doesn't flow very well. It really is very much of its time, but not necessarily in a good way. But anyway, what's happened is Ken Russell's decided to do this. Now, it's the 1980s. It's 1988. Okay. Ken Russell had a very interesting 1980s before that, he started out in the early 1960s doing some well-regarded television documentaries about various subjects, including famous composers, and really did make his name in a sense for that. And then in 1967, for some reason, Harry Salzman and Cubby Broccoli got him to make the third of the Harry Palmer movies for Michael Caine, which was Billion Dollar Brain. I like the movie a lot. I think it's got a real style to it and a real madness about it, which I kind of appreciate. And it's probably, apart from the Ipcress file, my favourite of the three. Anyway, he then went on to do a whole bunch of other movies, most of which were quite controversial. Just let me grab the IMDb on the stuff he did after Billion Dollar Brain. He did Women in Love in 1969, which had male nudity by Alan Bates and Oliver Reed in it, which made it controversial. He did The Music Lovers in 1970 with Glenda Jackson and Richard Chamberlain. Then he did The Devils, again with Oliver Reed, which was crazy controversial because it did have a go at organised religion at a time when it probably wasn't a wise thing to do if you didn't want to be criticised. He then went on to make a frothy little piece of a musical called The Boyfriend, starring Twiggy. He said after doing The Devils, you needed to do something light, so he did a musical. Then did Savage Messiah, Marla. He did the adaptation of The Who's rock opera Tommy, Listomania, which has got to be seen to be believed. He did a version of a movie about Rudolph Valentino, starring Rudolph Nureyev in 1977, which I haven't seen for a long time and I don't remember anything at all about. But the best thing he did Altered States in 1980, and there's where the shit started really hitting the fan, in that he had arguments with Paddy Chayefsky, he had arguments with the studio, he had arguments with William Hurt, the star of Altered States, and basically got chucked out of Hollywood in any reasonable sense of the word. So he had some real problems there. So it's 1980, right at the start of the 1980s, and he just can't get a movie made in Hollywood anymore. He did in 1983, and this was one of the first things I ever recorded off television, which was incredibly impressive. In 1983, he did something which I think is a fantastic work, if you can find it. He did a video adaptation of Holst's The Planets, the classical piece, with some striking visuals for the different planets of the solar system. And it's a beautiful piece of work. I'm really going to have to track it down, a copy of that, because it's got some incredibly memorable images to go along with Holst's The Planets, and really it is something worth treasuring. He then did a South Bank Show documentary about Vaughan Williams, the composer. And then it went on to do some crazy stuff like Crimes of Passion, starring Kathleen Turner and Anthony Perkins, which is kind of crazy. He did Faust. He did Gothic, which was more than a little crazy. He did a segment in Aria. He did Salome's Last Dance, which I have some fondness for, an adaptation of the Oscar Wilde play Salome. And then he did The Lair of the White Worm. Now, The Lair of the White Worm has an interesting cast. First off, it's got Hugh Grant playing his usual kind of privileged upper-class twit as Lord James Dampton. He does have a manservant played. There's a little cameo of a manservant thing played by Strafford Johnson, people remember from Softly, Softly and Z-Cars and things like that, where he tells him to run him a bath and all that kind of thing, and then the butler rolls his eyes and stuff like that. But it's just a typical Hugh Grant role. Not really nuanced in any way apart from just being, upper-class privileged bastard kind of thing. And to balance him out, we have Peter Capaldi, the new Doctor Who, as a young man with an incredibly crazy mop of wavy hair, a pair of Harry Potter glasses and a kilt, playing an archaeologist who's investigating the Dampton Worm, a famous mythical beast in the area, and in the farmhouse where his kind of girlfriend resides with her other friend. The girlfriend's name is Mary Trent, and her girlfriend's name is Eve Trent. It's a sister, actually. He finds an enormous skull of what could be a large worm or a large snake kind of object. And he takes it to Dampton. They get together. And basically they start investigating the worm. And the Trent sisters are then targeted by the owner of nearby Temple House, Lady Sylvia March, played by Amanda Donohoe, who basically steals the movie from everybody else and is so over the top it's ridiculous. Basically, she's a kind of snake vampire lady. She uses a sunbed. She walks around scantily clad. There's a scene where she picks up a Boy Scout who's lost in the countryside in the rain, takes him to her house, gives him a bath, gives him some food, and kind of devours him, which isn't the sort of thing one wants to have. Apparently, she's an immortal priestess of the snake god Dionin. And she kind of runs with that to the fullest extent. Now, the two ingenue women, Catherine Oxenberg's Eve and Sammy Davis's Mary, aren't very well portrayed. To be honest with you, I don't think the acting chops of these two actors are particularly good, particularly Sammy Davis, who's not like the Jewish black guy with one eye, but the English actress of the similar name. It's Sammy with an I in this case. Just doesn't have much acting chops, and she's very annoying. Her voice is very annoying, and she plays it like she's kind of playing Aladdin in a pantomime, which is really a weird and unusual choice to make on that. And she later appeared in The Rainbow, the adaptation of D.H. Lawrence's story done by Ken Russell, but in this she's just incredibly annoying. Apparently Russell originally wanted Tilda Swinton to play the Amanda Donohoe role. I could see Tilda Swinton really running with that. But she didn't, of course, appear in the movie. But it would have been an even more interesting film with Tilda Swinton in there. But there's just crazy imagery in this movie. And a lot of it is as crazy as the imagery in Russell's The Devils as well. There are snakes and snake-like phalluses and worms and exotic women and people on crucifixes and nuns. It's just got some... There's a scene, basically, what happens is, where the venom that Lady Sylvia spits has an hallucinogenic properties, and she spits it on a crucifix on the wall of the cottage where the two girls are living. Unfortunately, Mary touches the venom and immediately drops into massive hallucinations. Totally over the top, giant snake worms, women on crucifixes, nuns on crucifixes, just basically totally fucked up stuff, really. It doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie. It's just there so Ken Russell can run with it. The special effects aren't done particularly well. There's a lot of bleed through on some of the special effects, and they look incredibly dated now, but they've got a kind of over-the-top persuasive power about them. They're kind of what-the-fuck moments in this movie. Now, my friend Lucy Sussex, when I said I was going to do this movie for the podcast, said it's a bad movie, and I've got to agree with that. It is totally bad, but there's something about the movie that if you saw it with a bunch of people and you were sitting around with drinks, you could really have fun watching this film because it is just absurd and ridiculous and one of those films that you just got to see for that reason. Hugh Grant, of course, is another annoying human being. The only thing I've seen him in where he was any good at all, apart from Sirens, the Australian film, which I've got to talk about in a podcast at some stage in the future, is probably his work in Cloud Atlas. Most of the time he is fairly unrecognisable in that. But he does do a good bit of acting there. Maybe as his boyish good looks have faded, maybe he's kind of picked up his game a little bit. He's one of those actors who's known more for his personal life than for his acting skills, which is always something that's not a good way to go. You're going to end up being on a reality show somewhere if you do that kind of shit. But nonetheless, I like the movie. Seeing a young Peter Capaldi is always interesting too. You can see the start of that eccentricity that he brought to later roles. And he just kind of runs with the absurdity of it all and does a good job of it. But really, you've got to come back to Amanda Donohoe walking around topless with a snake dildo strapped around her waist, seducing Boy Scouts going over the top, biting people in the neck, and just kind of mixing that wonderful mixture that we have in a lot of horror movies, particularly of earlier years, of mixing sensuality with horror. It's always been something that appeals to a certain demographic, and unfortunately or fortunately, I'm sometimes in that demographic myself. And she is a lot of fun in it. And the thing is, this is a movie that I think people have taken a little too seriously for what it is. It's just basically fucking crazy. There's no other way to say it. It is a fucking crazy movie. It's an over-the-top one. It's ridiculous. It's mad. It's got some crazy imagery in it. Half of the actors aren't very good. The other half are in on the joke and are quite good. And yeah, for that reason, I like it. I don't think I'll watch it very often. It's not a movie I'm going to revisit endlessly. It's not a movie I'm going to revisit again, maybe for another 10 years. But I do think that it is a bit of fun, and it's one of those movies when you mention it to people who've seen it, they go, oh, fuck yeah, basically because of that insanity. And I like Ken Russell as a concept, in a sense. Before he died, he was actually a Facebook friend of mine, and he was saying outrageous things on Facebook too, which is always fun with these older celebrity kind of people when they get on Facebook. A lot of people are doing it. Adam West is doing it. He just pronounced that in 2015 he really loves the nerds that love his work. But one of the things I found out about Ken Russell, which makes him extra cool and makes him extra worthy of our regard in some ways, is he started his website back in the day. And I'm just going to get exactly what he said on the website, because this shows an interesting level of audacity by Ken Russell in the way he manages his life and the way he manages, in a very literal sense, his affairs. Let me see what I've got. He put an ad out on his own website, which is how he met his fourth wife. He said, "Unbankable film director Ken Russell seeks soulmate. Must be mad about music, movies, and Moët & Chandon champagne." And that's how he met his last wife, Lisa Trimble. So you've got to love that, whether somebody, you know, a celebrity opens a website, puts out an ad to meet his soulmate, and gets married based on it. You've got to love that, particularly given the fact the guy was in his 70s at the time. Let me see. There's a couple of quotes here from Ken Russell that I really want to run with. Okay, here's Ken Russell on his filmmaking. It kind of says it all about the guy himself, and this is a quote that I found on IMDb. "I know my films upset people. I want to upset people. This is not an age of manners. This is an age of kicking people in the crotch and telling them something and getting a reaction. I want to shock people into awareness. I don't believe there is any virtue in understatement." And he also said, "Life's too short to make destructive films about people one doesn't like. My films are meant to be constructive and illuminating." Now, you can take that with a grain of salt, I suppose, given the fact that I'm not sure how illuminated we need to be about a giant worm living under a hill in England and a crazy vampire snake lady who tends to bite on the dicks of erect Boy Scouts. So I think that Ken kind of had a good grip on his own sense of silliness. But it does raise the question of why was the movie made? And that's not an insubstantial question when we're talking about this movie. Did Ken Russell want to kind of create an old-fashioned Hammer-style vampire flick with a few Ken Russell twists to it? Did he just want to be as absurd and possibly offensive as he could to the audience? You really don't know, and it's really hard to pin that one down, because it's a movie that kind of sits in the middle there of basically someone going with the things he likes and doing so without much sense of an audience, which is kind of a bold and interesting way to approach a career in film, really. Nonetheless, he did it, and I've now talked about it in the podcast. So Lair of the White Worm, I can't say I recommend it. I think, in a sense, go for it if you want to. Otherwise, don't. But it is kind of silly and kind of outrageous, but it's consciously outrageous. And I think that may be the point that Ken Russell was coming to, that he wanted people to talk about it because it was shocking and because it did things other movies didn't, and because it was so over the top in a lot of its symbolism and in a lot of its naughty bits, in a sense, that I think maybe that's the point for Ken Russell, is that he wanted to be outrageous and silly, and he wanted people to say that it was outrageous and silly. So anyway, I'm going to take another break now. I'm going to get back. I'm going to talk about a much more substantial film, and it's a bit funny talking about a minor UK horror film, but there is a lot to be said about Deathline, a.k.a. Raw Meat.
The Megaphone Newsreel marches around the continent, across the seven seas, and right into your face. Yugoslavia. In a ritual as old as the word itself, Yugoslavian mountain men prepare to roll and slide down the face of the 38,000-foot Mount Krasny Dang in search of St. Buster's Button. A somber religious festival becomes even more somber when our Megaphone newsreel camera catches one of the brave Yugoslavian mountain men, then loses him, then catches him, then loses him, then finally catches him again in a tumble to tragedy on the steep mountainside. Disaster and sacred religious rituals mix under the brooding peaks of Mount Krasny Dang in Yugoslavia. Hollywood, California, where lovely film star Nita Olay shows perfect form as she tees off in the annual Celebrity Miniature Golf Tournament, attracting many of the movie capital's brightest names on behalf of the Panama Headache Relief Fund, a veritable panorama of the screen's most familiar faces, taking time out for fun and a worthy cause. The final hole, and Nita Olay misses a 2-inch putt to finish far down in the star-studded field. Lovely Nita Olay loses the Celebrity Miniature Golf Tournament, but she wins an even bigger prize, as after the tournament, she announces her engagement to her caddy. Wedding bells soon to chime for lovely Hollywood star Nita Olay. Turkey. Turkish troops begin annual maneuvers in the country's rugged eastern foothills as this cardboard tank fires volleys of tennis balls at the cardboard fort manned by Turkey's crack 17th Division. In realistic battle-like action, the 17th Division fights back with pea shooters and water pistols as overhead, mighty single-engined aircraft drop flour bags and the elite Turkish paratroop corps lands in a nearby field. Pillow fights in close hand-to-hand combat, and a monster cannon fires, unleashing a flag that says, bang! The modern Turkish army on maneuvers, as witnessed by our Megaphone newsreel camera. Switzerland. Our Megaphone newsreel camera takes to the air for a bird's eye view of the devastation wrought by Mother Nature in the sleepy Zut Valley of northeast Switzerland. There are no survivors from the avalanche that engulfed an entire village in its deadly shroud of white. Another brutal reminder of nature's awesome power, triggered, authorities say, by a ski instructor zipping up his fly. An avalanche in Switzerland, triggered by a ski instructor zipping up his fly. The Megaphone newsreel marches around the continent, across the seven seas, and right into your face.
Beneath modern London, in plague-ridden tunnels, a tribe of once human. Neither men nor women, they are less than animals. The raw meat of the human race. Who stalks those deadly shadows? Whose cry echoes their horror? Whose blood will flow when they strike again?
Are you sure he was alive when you left him?
How many times?
Are you absolutely certain he didn't come up after?
Yes.
You mean he did?
He did not.
I think we were lucky.
Why?
Whatever he saw was probably watching us.
Well, how could they survive without food?
Because I should imagine that as each one died, the others ate him.
Is there any way out of here except up those stairs?
Drop it.
Why the nephew?
Is there? Oh. You tell me!
What strange hunger drives them to prey on the young and strong? An experience in ultimate terror. So fearful that no additional scenes can be shown in this preview.
Okay, Death Line is a 1972 British horror film. IMDb has it as 1973 under the American name Raw Meat, but it's actually a 1972 British horror film. It was directed by an American called Gary Sherman and stars Donald Pleasence, Norman Rossington, David Ladd, Sharon Gurney, Hugh Armstrong, and it has a cameo from none other than Christopher Lee. I'll read you a bit of the Wikipedia page for it. I won't go through all of it because there are spoilers there. A family of cannibals descended from Victoria-era railway workers who were buried alive during construction of underground railway lines in London continue to dwell in the disused line of the London Underground Tube Network. The last member of the family frequently visits a neighbouring Russell Square station, Russell Square and Holborn stations to pick off passengers for food, then takes them back to a gruesome pantry in an incomplete station. When the cannibal kidnaps and kills an important politician, he is hunted by a detective as well as an American college student and his English girlfriend, who were the last to see the victim in the tube station. The coppers are played by Donald Pleasence and Norman Rossington. And there's a really nice climax to the film. There are a couple of things about this film. First off, it's very well made. There's a lot to be said. The cinematography is good. The special effects and the kind of light gore effects in the film are good for their time. Now, you've got to remember that things now are a lot different and things now can be shown that just simply weren't able to be done without actually killing anybody in the past. But this one holds up pretty well. I rewatched it about 3 days ago, and the special effects really did impress me. They're gruesome enough to make you a bit queasy even these days. And there's one long tracking shot when the camera tracks through the lair of this last survivor of the underground railway workers, who they track from a dismembered foot through the entire larder that this guy has created out of the corpses of people, including an actor called James Cossens, who plays the missing politician, through where the guy is sitting with his ill wife who is pregnant. She eventually does die. It's not too much of a spoiler to say that. But and into the kind of vast underground vault of the disused railway line, and then they go right up to the point where there's an enormous landfall where things have collapsed, trapping them down there. And then they kind of pan through to an active railway station in London. It's about a 2 or 3 minute tracking shot, and there are some cuts that are hidden by bits of darkness, but it's a audacious move to make in this kind of a horror film. It's not a big budget film by any means. It's not kind of didn't have a hell of a big studio support, but to do that kind of a tracking shot and to do it to convey visually the world that this last survivor lives in is a good move, and you've got to admire them for that. But the things I take away from this movie most of all are Donald Pleasence and Norman Rossington. Now, Donald Pleasence, we know he was in The Great Escape. He was in Escape from New York. A great character. He was also in, Polanski's Cul-de-Sac. So he's had a long career. Started out before he was an actor. He was actually a prisoner of war in one of the prisoner of war camps in World War II, very similar to the one that his character was in The Great Escape. But a really great character actor, and in this movie, he is having fun with the role. Now, there's an underlying current, even under the horror of having a cannibal grabbing people off tube stations in London, there's an underlying class warfare kind of theme in this film, which I only noticed watching it this time and which I really appreciated, because the copper played by Donald Pleasance, whose name is Inspector Calhoun, is unashamedly working class. And he waves it like a banner. He jams up the nose. He's off-sider, played by Norman Rossington, Detective Sergeant Rogers, is slightly upper class. Norman Rossington, interesting actor. He was in the first four Carry On movies, which is, I knew I'd seen him recently, and I've been watching the Carry On films. But in this, he's playing a serious role, but he's playing basically the straight man to Donald Pleasance, who in this film is just going to town with having fun with the role. And it's really an odd kind of copper role to have in a horror film. In a horror film, you expect the coppers to be upright and maybe a bit thick at learning that something's going on here, and obstructionist to the young couple who are trying to find out what actually happened. The young couple, played by David Ladd and Sharon Gurney. David Ladd, interesting guy, son of Alan Ladd, the actor. He was married to Cheryl Ladd at one stage, and he's the father to a modern actor, Jordan Ladd. Didn't have much of a career himself, and to be honest with you, he's not much chops as an actor. A bit like his girlfriend, played by Sharon Gurney. Now, both of these films I've mentioned in this podcast, I've mentioned how bad some of the actors are, but maybe it's an experience, maybe it's lack of training, maybe it's a lack of talent, who knows. But when you have a few actors in these films that shine, they tend to draw attention to the people who don't, which is one of the unfortunate things about it. But in this one, Donald Pleasance really does bring a lightness to the thing. And there are some very grim and quite frightening parts of this film. But Donald Pleasance's presence brings a lightness to it and a lot of fun there. He does have one great scene with Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee's playing an MI5 operative in the suit and bowler hat. He's really done up upper class. He's got a rolled umbrella. He's got a pinstripe suit. He's got a bowler hat on his head. He's got an upper class military mustache. And he's kind of warning Inspector Calhoun off. And the interesting thing about that is that even Christopher Lee is playing it slightly tongue-in-cheek in that scene. And I won't play it for you because I want you to enjoy it yourself when you see the movie. And he and Pleasance are just having a bit of fun with the roles. And it's a delight to see him. More and more, I really appreciate it when you can tell that actors are having fun with what they're doing. Yeah, there are places where it's not appropriate for them to do that, and there are, of course, kinds of films and kinds of scenes where it's just the wrong thing to do. But in something like this, when you see people getting a bit kind of winsome and playful, it's a delight, and it kind of lifts the film in a lot of ways, and I think this film would be a much lesser one without Donald Pleasance. So you've got that working-class tension there between Donald Pleasance and the Christopher Lee character, whose name is hyphenated, Stratton Villiers from MI5 is his name. And he, there's class warfare there. There's a kind of class warfare between the working class copper who knows what he's doing and he's going through things very methodically and he's quite intelligent. He's almost like an English Columbo in some ways without being quite as theatrical as Peter Falk was in that iconic role. But Pleasance, that's one of the dynamics. The other dynamic is between Pleasance playing the middle-aged working-class copper going up against the long-haired student played by David Ladd. He even has a little bit of fun at the end of one of the scenes going, get a haircut, and that kind of thing. And he's smiling when he says it, so you know he's not serious about playing the youth versus the authorities dynamic there. But he does it anyway. And so there's that tension there, and David Ladd's character, Alex, plays things very seriously and really doesn't seem to be in on the joke of Inspector Calhoun to a great extent. So that's two parts of it. There's the youth versus authority. There's the working class versus the upper class MI5 guy. Then you've got the other thing, which is the whole engine of the story in the Victorian England. A whole bunch of railway workers and their families were trapped underground and left there because the company went bankrupt and there wasn't money to get them out. So everybody just assumed that they had died. Turns out that they didn't, and they survived eating rats and eating eventually human beings. And their kind of inbred disease descendants, and there are some serious diseases they find in the blood of the character called the Man, played by Hugh Armstrong, which leads you to believe that he, as the last descendant of this poor group of people and tragic group of people, is not long for this world anyway. And that's the third dynamic, is of course that the class warfare, the fact that they didn't bother getting the workers out way back in the late 19th century. And that's the whole engine for the horrors that do happen here. Now, I've mentioned Donald Pleasence and Norman Rossington having a lot of fun, and of course Christopher Lee having a lot of fun as an actor. But there's another wheel to this one, and that is Hugh Armstrong, an actor who didn't have an extensive career in cinema from what I could see from the IMDb page. But him playing the Man, as he's called, is fucking spectacular. He's right up there with characters like Boris Karloff playing the monster in Frankenstein and Richard Wadsworth playing the monster in the first Quatermass movie. He doesn't have much dialogue. Most of his character is shown through action. The only words he ever says are "mind the doors," which is something that they used to have when there were people on the platforms of the trains to get tell people that the doors were about to close. And that's the only real words he ever speaks. And you see the two sides of him. First off, you see him, he's immensely strong. He's by any reasonable criteria, insane. But back in his lair, he's got a pregnant wife who's ill and who eventually is dying and dies. And not only are you led into his feelings as a person for the fact that his wife's dying and he doesn't know what to do about it, has nothing to do about it, and doesn't have the education or the background or even the knowledge to know that there are ways in which she can be helped. So you've got that. Then you've got his grief once she does die. And that becomes a part of the events that occur. And this role this movie is intelligently done for a lot of reasons. And the best one is that the monster in the film is humanized to a greater extent than some of the other main characters. His motivations are very clear, and he speaks three words in the whole movie, kind of like Groot in Guardians of the Galaxy, I suppose. But he only says three words in the whole movie. But we have an incredibly clear vision of who he is, the frustration and fear and tragedy of his circumstances, which ultimately aren't of his making, and the fact that he only has one food source, and that's other human beings. He doesn't know that you can go up to the surface. He probably doesn't even know the surface is there. He just knows that if he goes and to this place, there will be beings that he can use for food. And in that sense, his world extends from the railway platform where he grabs the people all the way back to his lair and no further than that. And that makes for a very creepy and interesting portrayal. And there's even a bit more there, because when he does go up on the platform, he finds two railway workers at one stage and fights them. And one of the railway workers bashes him on the side of the head with the fluffy end of a broom, before he kills them both, of course. But he's also got an ear injury and an injury to the side of his head. And he then, of course, this being the kind of horror movie it is, he then kidnaps the girlfriend played by Sharon Gurney and takes her back to the lair. And at various times during that kidnapping and the subsequent rescue and struggle there, he's hit on the side of the head and is in total agony about it. He's basically an injured animal in a sense. And Gurney, the only time she really comes good in this role is when she's screaming and struggling. She, as an actor with dialogue, she doesn't do very good, but she's good as the kind of screaming girl character, which is, I'm sorry if it's condemnation of her as an actor, but in this role, this is where she is at her best, which is when the situation gets worse for her character. And she eventually does, in spite of the fact she's been kidnapped and an attempted assault is made on her by the man, she does have sympathy for him as a character. She does have kind of realise his circumstances and realise what's going on here. And when other people are come to rescue her, she defends him in some ways, which is kind of interesting too. You could go with the cliches in this kind of movie very, very easily. You could go with the stuff that has been done a dozen times before, a hundred times before. Or you can think your concept through and bring something new to the game. And I think that this movie very much does that. It does it in a lot of different ways. It does it in the selection of the coppers. The coppers could have been cliches very, very easily. It could have been played upright and straightforward and with no frills of character. But that doesn't happen. The coppers are human beings in this movie, which is shown most of all when, after a long day of investigating, the Inspector Calhoun takes his offsider, Detective Sergeant Rogers, out for a drink, and they end up getting shit-faced in the pub and staying at closing time and trying to play pinball when the pinball machine's covered with the glasses they've drunk out of. And there's some nice interplay between the two coppers and the publican, played by an actor called James Cullenford, where the publican's trying to get the two coppers to leave the premises, and Donald Pleasance, as the inspector, plays on the fact that he's serving drinks after closing time and all that kind of thing. So there's that as well, which has got nothing to do with the main thrust of the movie at all. It's a character piece, and they do let it go and let these characters have a time when they're not being coppers, which is kind of interesting. And then, of course, everything comes to the head the next day while they're hungover, which makes it slightly funny as well. But this film, at the time, I found it very horrifying when I first saw it. And rewatching it now, it's got a lot more going for it than I ever realised. It's got those extra touches of character on everybody concerned, except for the young ingenues, which is where character is mostly invested in this kind of movie. The Alex and Patricia, the boyfriend and girlfriend in the film, are normally where a lot of character development is invested in these films. And there are some things where she kind of leaves him for being a bit of a bastard and then comes back again and they get back together. But it's done in such a way that we want to get back to the coppers, or we want to get back to the man. We want to get back to the characters who are vivid and interesting and kind of well inhabited by the actors, which again is a bit of a condemnation of David Ladd, Sharon Gurney, but it can't be helped. But it does, in a positive sense, help to differentiate this from other horror movies in the fact that most of the time the characters we're barracking for are the young man and young woman. But in this case, no, we're barracking for the coppers, and we're barracking in a twisted and sad sense for the man. Even though he's a cannibal murderer, he is a not unsympathetic character. And that's pretty fucking spectacular for this kind of film. And it's something that really lifts it in my regard. Now, they did film it in disused British tube stations as well. There's a station between Holborn and the British Museum, which was used at the time. It's now called, what is it called? Aldwych Station. So it does use location very well. Even on the streets of London and in the pub where the inspector and his offsider get drunk, it's all location shooting. It's not studio sets. There are some studio sets used in the film, but they're used very well and very sparingly. Now, Ramsay Campbell, who himself is no light person when it comes to writing horror, called the movie an unusually bleak and harrowing horror film. Very little of the film offers the audience any relief from the plight of the man. The violence would be intolerable if it were not for the tragic dimensions of the film. But Hugh Armstrong's performance is one of the greatest and most moving in horror films, which is high regard indeed. And to be honest with you, I can't disagree with it. I really think that this film is one that should be higher in the pantheon of horror films, even though it only got a bare bones release about 5 or 6 years ago on DVD, and it hasn't had a release in Australia. I know it's had a release in America, which is where I got my copy of it from. You'll pick it up for not too much money if you go to Amazon or one of those places. And I don't know whether it's streaming anywhere on Netflix or something like that. But if not, it should be. And I think that you should see it if you haven't. It really does work as a horror film. I'm quite happy too for another reason. Fairly recently, before I decided I was going to do this movie for the podcast, I was browsing through eBay and found one of the Daybill movie posters for Deathline. One of the Australian Daybill movie posters, and I picked it up from eBay. So I've now got the movie poster. Unfortunately, it's only in three colours, black, white and green. There are some that are in full colour, but this one's one of the later Daybill posters, so it's not in full colour. But nonetheless, I'm glad I've got a copy of it, and I'm glad I actually paid for the movie, because even if the rights have gone somewhere else, it's one of those movies that I want to respect enough to get a legitimate copy of. And so Deathline's definitely, it's probably one of my favourite rewatches in the last few months, because I saw much more in the film than I'd ever seen in it before. And that's no thanks to me, it's more thanks to the quality of the movie. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back. I do have some feedback to share. And then, of course, we're going to do the credits for the people who have supported the podcast via the Patreon campaign.
What do you think of my powers now?
American International presents Abby, the story of a woman possessed. She took the devil for a lover, and he possessed her body and soul. Abby, a story of terror, lust, and exorcism.
Grab her arms and hold her.
Abby, starring William Marshall as the exorcist.
I command you to vacate this body now.
And Carol Speed as Abby. Can anyone stop her? Can anyone help her? Can anyone save her soul?
I've got Abby!
Abby, the story of a woman possessed. Rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
Okay, the first bit of feedback is from Dave Brandt, who sent me an email saying, "Hi Terry and Sal, hope you enjoy having a happy Newton's birthday on the sacred time of year on which we celebrate the Enlightenment, and especially Sal's return home and recovery. On another happy note, I thought I'd tell you about an All Bond podcast which was finally released over here. It's hard to find, so I thought I'd alert you. A couple of years ago, a computer freak who goes by the name of Gruber decided to review all the Bond movies inside his tech/nerd podcast. They're great, but they're all embedded inside the nerd podcast and were never broken up into their own feed. Also, they didn't have chapter markers to denote where the technobabble stopped and the Bondcast started. This meant that you'd have to hunt through the noise to find the proper starting point. So why bother? The great news is that this month, an obscenely wealthy American software magnate extracted the Bond reviews from the Technobabble and posted them separately. He's announced the series here, and I'll put the link on the show notes, and the feed is here. I'm part of the feed. That's pretty much it, but cheers, David. So Dave Brandt has sent me the link to our Bond podcast. I've got to let you know that there's also another one too. If you go to randomalex.net, that's randomalex, you'll see the great big long wonderful series of essays where Alex Pierce and her partner have watched all of the Bond movies and reviewed them, partly from a feminist viewpoint, which is really cool and groovy, but partly not. Also, there's a lot of other good stuff on Alex's blog, so it's worth visiting. So I'll post both lots of show notes up on the website at marsdriving.blogspot.com so that everybody can enjoy the wonderfulness of both of those things. So, yeah, thanks for that, Dave, and thank you for listening and for hipping me to the good stuff. Now, I've also got another email, which came at me from Chris Lampard, who says, "Hey, Terry, it's the first one I've listened to. He enjoyed episode 49 of Martian Driving. Hey, Terry, it's the first one I've listened to, and I really enjoyed it. I like the way you intercut music with chat, and the chat was very interesting. I arrived at your podcast from The Writer and the Critic. Very glad I did. Let's see, episode 49. That's a good back catalogue to browse through. Is there a list of movies you reviewed, please? Cheers, Chris." Yeah, there is, Chris, and I sent Chris the link through to the there's a letterbox that Paul White did, which has a visual list of all of the Martian Driving and in the Paleo Cinema podcast movies, which is a massive undertaking by Paul, and thank you for that, Paul, which I'll also post up on the show notes as well, just so everybody's got a chance to check them out and enjoy them, which is kind of cool and groovy. And I kind of like looking back at those kind of visual lists of the films that I've covered, and it always blows me away how many there are and how widespread they are. And it also helps me see gaps in them as well, things that are genres or subgenres or types of film that I haven't really covered. Seeing them more visually helps give me an idea of the stuff that I haven't covered yet, that I do want to cover, or that maybe just kind of slipped under the radar that tiny little bit. So anyway, that's about it for the feedback. Again, you can contact me at cultguruwithak@gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can go to marsdriving.blogspot.com or paleo-cinema.blogspot.com for the show notes on each show. Anyway, that's about it. I'm going to do the credits again as usual and just remind people that if you go to patreon.com/paleocinema, you can do a micro payment to help the podcast financially. These things do cost a little money, not megabucks, even though I'd love that. If somebody wants to give megabucks, please feel free. But just a little bit every now and then does help with things like I've got a new webcam, which I'm doing occasional previews of the next episode of the podcast. I'm putting them up on YouTube. Should post a link to that as well, I suppose. And that just those kind of little things. The microphone I'm talking into, in fact, was paid for by the Patreon campaign. And thanks again to all of the people who've supported us. And thanks to you for listening. I'll be back in next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I have no idea what I'm doing on either of those things, but something will come up. Boom tish. Anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves. Stay warm if you're up north. Stay cold if you're down south. And enjoy watching movies. And, of course, watch the skies. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.